Hello and welcome to the Not So Alpha Males podcast, the show where every other Thursday, two cool nerds, that's me and you, bro, delve into the worlds of science, psychology, and everything in between. Brought to you, as always, by your hosts, me, Tom.
Me, Toby, but don't ever call me bro again. We're not bros.
I thought, are we not that, level? What level are we at?
I mean, we're podcasters, that's all we are, mate. We're just acquaintances.
Acquaintances. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've been telling a few people friend-like.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that pushing it? I'll put it back down to the acquaintance.
Going, I mean, forward. It depends how much you want
to pay. Okay, you're not worth it. Anyway, today's topics that we're going to go through, I'm going to be talking to you about a company called Neuralink. Earlier in the week, I posted a video on our Instagram. Have a very crazy sci-fi kind of thing of a monkey playing a game with its brain. So I'm going to be going into that a bit more. And Toby, what are you talking about this week?
I'm talking about the light bulb cartel. Ooh. And yeah, I know, very mysterious. And basically how companies trick you and make you buy things when you probably don't need to.
Oh, interesting. Oh, kind of like the iPhone-y things and slowing stuff down. Is that
we'll
it?
Get there.
I'm teasing. Anyway, and of course, we're going to be drinking throughout the whole episode. We actually started a bit earlier before recording this week, so we're going to see how this goes, because normally the first half is still sober, but we're on the line. What are you drinking this week?
It's a good question, because I've completely forgot. I need to drink. One second.
It's such a good start. You see what I mean? While we started drinking before recording, that's not going to happen again. Oh, dear. And whilst we wait for Toby to go find the book to find the name of this cocktail, I'm going to serenade you with a little song that I wrote. Buttercup, buttercup, oh, butter, 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 buttercup. Ba-doom, doom, doom. There you go. That's all I've got so far. Please leave your comments on our Instagram page and let me know what you thought.
Okay,
what's the name?
So the cocktail is Love in the Mist. Yeah, we've got some rhubarb gin. We've got some Cointreau. We've got some Cointreau. Correct. Okay. We've got freshly squeezed lemon juice. We've got some orange liqueur in there as well, and a bit of tonic. So it's really Love in the Mist.
Very nice. A lot going on there. I like it.
It's a lot going on. I've got a little orange peel on the top as well, which you'll be able to see in the good Instagram picture. Yeah. What about yours?
I've kind of copped out this week because of the rush that we're in at the moment. And it's just a screwdriver. So, you know, vodka and orange. Just out of interest, actually, do you know why it's called a screwdriver? Like, what's vodka orange got to do with screwdrivers?
I hope you're going to tell us.
No, I'm actually asking you.
I have no idea.
Oh, I just thought it was really weird. Why is it not
but
called?
It is a cop-out. I'm disappointed that you just go for vodka orange juice.
Well, okay. Well, I'm going to swiftly move on. Anyway, yes, go check us out on Instagram as well, at Not So Alpha Males, where we are now posting a lot more updates. We're trying to be a bit more interactive, aren't we? And that just keeps you up to date with the episodes.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to add? No?
No, I've got nothing.
Okay, let's get into the podcast. Roll the music. So, yes, this week I'm going to be delving into that video that I put up. So, I mean, it's pretty crazy. Do you see it, Toby? Did you watch what I put up? Do you care about this podcast as much as me?
I did. You did force me to watch it, so I did see it. And
fair enough.
It was quite cool, to be fair. But for all the people that didn't see it, you probably should give them the lowdown, right?
Yes, I will. And it will be in this week's episode post. So if you want, go pause again right now. I'm always doing that in each episode now. Go pause, go to the Instagram and check it out.
Hey, they're missing so much when they don't follow the Instagram, don't you think? They're missing so
much. I do. You have so to go follow, guys. You have to go follow. Anyway, so it was a monkey who has recently had a brain chip implanted, which allows, short version, the electrical signals to be monitored and recorded, and then you can use those to actually control something. And this monkey is playing a game with its brain. So it's not using its hands to control or anything. It's just using its thoughts, which is kind of a scary concept, really.
It's bloody good as well. Bloody good at the game.
He was very good at the game. He was doing not, it very like fast. Shit, right? No, yeah. He's better than probably I could do. Anyway, so I'm going to start off by talking about brain-machine interfaces in general and how they actually work before getting into the actual monkey that we saw in the video, because that in itself is a huge, huge leap forward and a bit of a breakthrough for the field. So brain-machine interfaces, these describe a direct communication pathway between an enhanced or wired brain and an external device. So take your computer, for example. Rather than having to use your fingers to type and input to a computer that way, all you have to do this is think what you want to type, and then the device in your brain will then send that to the computer and it will type the letters out on the computer itself. So it all started after the discovery of the electrical activity that a human brain exhibits. And this was way back in 1924 by a German psychiatrist called Hans Burgers. And he was the inventor. And now this is one hell of a word, so I'm probably going to get it wrong. Thank God it's got an acronym, though. Electroencephalography. There we go. That's what it is. That's exactly
sounds good to me.
That's exactly how you say it. But for the sakes of this podcast and for everyone listening, it's EEG. So I'll be using that a lot. And basically, that's a method or device to be able to monitor the electricity essentially happening inside your brain due to the reactions going on when you think. We've all actually probably seen these. You have too. So you know those. I mean, I don't know how to describe these. Head garments, but the kind of food hair net type things with the electrodes
the
in
wires coming out. Dump,
yeah, a whole load of wires coming out the back and then into a computer. That's a EEG device, and that is basically them measuring all the electrical conductivity going on in your brain. And so for a long time, that's all we could do, really, because it's a very non-invasive, you know, a person just has to wear a cap. I call it a cap, but it's not really a cap, but wear something on the outside of their head, and then you can start measuring. But then that has a lot of barriers to how accurate it can be.
It might be a stupid question, but how do we make electrical signals in our brain?
I'm glad you asked, because I'm going to go into that in detail to bore you to death. No. No, how it works, I've thought this as well, and it's kind of mad. So what is this actual electrical activity going on in your brain? So starting off on the sort of bigger scale, your brain cells themselves, every neuron, communicate with each other via electrical impulses. And so these neurons, as a very, very oversimplification of their physical representation, I guess you could say, is imagine two trees stuck together at the base of the trunks. So you've got one side with loads of branches and then a long, thin body, and then the other side's got loads of branches. That's how a neuron looks. Yeah? You with me? You look confused.
I might have to describe that again.
Okay. So a neuron is a load of branches. Think of like an arm extending into a hand with five fingers, but many, many more fingers. And on the other side, there's another hand as well. So it's like two expanding branches off one central column. One end are called the dendrites, and the other end is called the synapses. And then the long bit in between is called the axon. And now cells talk to each other by the synapse of one neuron connecting to the dendrite of multiple other neurons. And that's where you get the huge sort of interconnectivity of the brain. So every neuron will have loads and loads of branch dendrites coming out one end. And then each one individually then connects to one individual synapse of another end of another neuron. And then you've got that whole interconnected kind of structure set up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like a big web.
Yeah, a bit like a big spider's web, yeah. So let's look at just one neuron then and how the signal, how the electrical impulse sort of exists and travels along that to the next one, because that's all that the impulse is like an electrical current moving the same way it would move down a wire, but that's in terms of electrons. This is slightly different, but when you think of like electricity and it's the movement of electrons down a wire, but it's the same kind of concept with the neurons. There's an electrical conductivity moving down each axon across the dendrite synapse connection, down the next axon of another neuron, and then basically that whole entire chain's made up. Make sense?
Yes.
So looking at just one neuron, say a signal comes into its dendrites, what happens then is a chemical substances called neurotransmitters are released from the previous neuron, from its synapses, and then those neurotransmitters float out into the space and then over to the dendrites of the next neuron, and then the dendrite picks them up. And you know neurotransmitters, they are just various molecules you have in your body, and you've probably heard of a few. So dopamine's one, and that's mainly involved in the movement signals of your body. So if you want to move a body part, and interestingly enough, someone with Parkinson's disease is the inability to produce enough dopamine. And so that's what results in like the stiffness, the tremors and things like that, because it's basically messing up with the movement responsible neurotransmitter. Another one, serotonin. So that one helps regulate your mood and appetite and regulates your sleep pattern and things like that when it's released. So going back to actually what the electrical activity is, I'm going to try and not go really, really in depth because it is quite physicsy, very, very chemical, and even I'm a bit lost with it. So I'm doing a very simplification here for your sakes, Toby, not mine, obviously.
I appreciate
keep you
it.
In the loop. Yeah. So these neurotransmitters cause the membrane of the next neuron to actually open up. And what it is then surrounding all the neurons in your brain is basically loads of ions. So like positively or negatively charged molecules. And then when these neurotransmitters cause the neuron membrane to open, they all flood into the body. And that's essentially then a huge change in the voltage difference across the membrane. And that switching, as they all flow in, causes the voltage change. And that's what then can be picked up by an electrode of an EEG. And then passes down. It tells the synapses of that neuron to then release the transmitters again. And then that goes on to the next neuron. It opens up its membranes, and then the spike's seen there. So you can then just see this spike going across each neuron.
Track it.
And that's how the sort of signal is formed.
Okay. Hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Because that's the most difficult part to understand with this whole topic. So,
can they work out like what parts of the brain is for what? Mm-hmm. Say, like if I think of happy things, it will send off voltage drops around that area.
Yeah, and that's where so much of sort of brain research has been. You could only really do parts of the brain because you had only those non-invasive HAT methods, which are very like you can't have loads of electrodes on those. Obviously, it's very very it's very very coarse. Its measurements, so you can't see whereabouts in the brain exactly it is and just pick areas. So you go, oh, that area is to do with emotions. That's more sight. And that's how you sort of build the brain up. But now we're getting a lot more accurate.
So is that voltage drop, can they record it? Say if it's like right in the middle of the brain, like does it show that through that thickness of the brain, or is it just on that top surface of the brain that it kind of works on?
Yes, from what I've read, I think you pick up actually a lot of it, even with the non-invasive techniques that we've had in the past, because I've seen the hardest thing with it, trying to work this stuff out, is all the noise and the background electrodes popping off. Because obviously, you're constantly looking, so all your sight neurons are constantly firing and functioning. So you've got to like, know, okay, that bit's to do with that. If I'm looking at emotion, I don't want to look at that bit. So it's all jumbled together, and finding the actual signals to do with what you're concerned with has been very, very difficult. And that's when in more recent times, we've gone into more invasive techniques, which is actually putting electrodes down into the brain in different areas. And so you get a much more accurate picture. You can really lock into an area that you want to look at. And basically, it's just moving the technology forward. But obviously, there's a big difference in terms of like ethics and like, do people want to do it compared to wearing a hat to having something actually implanted and stuck down into their brain? So that's how it works. That's how the electricity works side of things. How the actual monkey one then works is, yeah, essentially what they did. It's very simple now, really, once you've got a method to actually pick up the electrical signals in a very refined and accurate way, is you get yourself a monkey, get yourself the game Pong with a little joystick to move the... What is it? Is it a paddle, do you call it in Pong game? I call it a paddle. And then, yeah, a little joystick to control it. And then you get it to play. And I think in this, they just did like a rewards thing. So just like gave the monkey a banana smoothie when it was playing, and it obviously scored points. It got more smoothie, something like that. And then you essentially record what's going on in the brain when he's playing, when he's doing a movement up, when he's doing a movement down, because that's will be a slightly different signature inside the brain. And then once you've got that, the next step then is just to build a computer which can then read real-time data coming in from a brain and spot those patterns in real time, and then be like, oh, that's the signature, which is a brain saying move the joystick upwards or move the joystick down. And then you can connect that computer to a joystick and have it do that way. So that bit's kind of like very simple.
That's just up and down, right? It's nothing.
Yes, yeah. That's all there was with the actual monkey thing, was an up and down. But he did play some other games which was had like right, left, and then a combination of both. So the accuracy of what you can depict and what signals you can grab, it's basically just learning what every action is in a signature, like building that database up. It'll get to the point where the signature, when you say the word the or the word any word, you'll know each individual signature, pick it up, and you'll be like, okay, I know what that person's gonna say. And that's when you get into like the craziness of mind reading and mind control games and all sorts that I'll get into.
Do you think, well, is it the case that everyone has a slightly different signature? Or it's like, if I said hello, would it have a different reading to what your hello would be?
I don't know. That's an interesting one, that is.
Because like, it would have to be tuned for like each individual case.
Yeah. I actually don't think it would be. I mean, I don't know how accurate you have to be. Like, obviously, you don't need to look at the individual neurons, because obviously the individual neuron for my the might be a different neuron position than your the. But the area and the pattern of it traveling through, I assume, must be quite similar. Like we all must use the same kind of area to move an arm or not move an arm. I don't know. That's an interesting question, though.
It's whether like how specific it needs to be.
Yeah.
In that area, yeah. If it's just kind of like in the vicinity, then it would work.
And to shout them out, this whole monkey brain control was done by Neuralink, from our best friend that we keep on bringing up in this podcast, Elon Musk, the founder.
Why wouldn't he join the podcast, man? I don't understand. Like,
he needs
how
to
many
reply
times now.
He just needs to reply to our messages.
Yeah, I think we need to hashtag him in this one. I think that
shall
might
we? Yeah. I think he'll see, and then he'll be like, "Oh yeah, I'll get on that podcast," and then yeah. We can actually find out that everything I'm saying.
Episode 8, guys. Look forward to it. He'll be on. It's fine.
So, yeah. So how the chip then works is quite simple. It's like a little onboard computer that can depict the electrical signals in real time happening in your brain. And then it understands if they are, say, in the case of Pong, move the cursor up, or I want to move the cursor down. And then wirelessly that then connects to the game and moves the cursor up or down. Same way that remote
there's
control.
No, like, wire.
No completely wire? Wireless. Yeah. And that's another interesting thing as well. The implant itself, which I'll get into in a second, is charged wirelessly. Which I was thinking about this. I was like, okay, so say in the future we all have these chips then, and we're all enhanced beings. Does that mean that we like have to, when we go to bed, our pillow will have to be like a wireless charging pad? You know, like how you've got them for the phones? Because every night you've got to charge up your... Because otherwise it's like a plug-in thing, which means you've only got to sit somewhere and charge it, which is a bit long.
I don't know. You could so easily build it in though, couldn't you? Like just the headphones in your head, like they could be charging you.
Yeah, but what, you got to sit next to a socket then? Like you want to go out, you're like, wait there, I've got to do 5% more, and you just got to sit there like you do when you wait for your phone to charge. You've got like a 2-meter cable tethering you to the wall.
Just have a portable charger, just walk around with your phone.
Yeah, yeah. So interesting things to come in the future on that front. So yeah, going into the actual chip itself, it's just a small circular, like a coin, measuring 23 millimeters in diameter, so like just over 2 centimeters. So what's that like? It's like a 2p coin. £2 coin.
23 millimetres, you say,
yeah? Yeah, 2 centimetre diameter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's then the actual depth thickness of your skull itself. Because what it does is, in the procedure of having it implanted, they cut out a little circular disc of your skull, put the sensor there, and then you don't get the skull put on top. It is your skull, essentially. And then the skin's closed up over the top. So the same way you have like a metal hip replacement or something, you're having a bit of your skull replaced. So
is there any issues with rejection and stuff like that?
That, yeah, no, the exact same issues as when you have a hip, you might get rejection. But I think we know enough about biology and metallurgy to know what works and what doesn't these days, and if it's going to work with someone's, if a body would reject it or not. So I don't think that's actually like a big problem with it. Like, we've been putting foreign objects into people's bodies for a long time.
You know all about that, Tom.
I look, for everyone at home, we just stared at each other like, yeah, make the joke, mate. Yeah. Anyway, and then emanating from the chip itself is a whole bunch of tiny, tiny wires, which measure the quarter of the diameter of a human hair. That's how thin these wires are, which is 4 to 6 micrometers. So tiny, tiny little wires. And then basically, yeah, the wires slide down into the brain, into different areas with this brand new machine they made, which is very cool. I'll talk about it a bit more in a second. And then along that wire are basically numerous electrodes. So instead of having like the electrodes on a hat on the outside, little circles everywhere, they're on this little wire, tiny ones that are just scattered all the way down the wire. And so you can measure everything going on along the depth of the wire into your brain.
So how far does the wire go into your brain then?
Very good question. At the moment, they've only gone 6 millimeters into the brain. They've said that their machine can do a hell of a lot deeper, but they've just not done that yet. Whether that's because to control the game Pong, you just need the electrical activity going on in the first 6 millimeters of the brain in one location. I don't know. They've not explored that. And they haven't said specifically how far they can go in. But I presume the further you go in, the more dangerous it's all becoming. Because, I mean, I don't know what the brain anatomy is, but I feel like the more important stuff's probably really at the core, near the spine. And then the stuff on the outside's a bit, doesn't matter.
Just getting Pong in it.
Yeah, exactly. So this machine then, which is called the sewing machine, it's a surgery that they've all designed themselves, and it consists of 3 parts. The first being opening, where a neurosurgeon comes along, you know, makes little slits, opens it up, and then removes the bit of skull that needs to go, and then like removes a bit of the dura membrane, which is something that covers the brain itself. And then the robot comes along, and with a collection of sensors and cameras and all sorts, can then fiddle the wires down into the brain, into the locations they want, plops them there, and then retracts itself out. I'm imagining some sort of like snaky thing coming in and out of your brain at this point, 6 millimeters. And then the robot gets moved along, and then the surgeon comes back, closes it all up, and there you go. You now have a chip inside your brain. Crazy.
I don't know how I'd feel about that. Just makes me feel a bit like funny about it, not just even hearing it.
I guess the bigger question then, going away from the monkey side of things, is like, why are we trying to do this anyway? And there's a lot of reasons. The main one that's been fueling all the research so far is medical reasons. So basically curing all kinds of brain-based diseases. So when you have a stroke, you could help solve that. Because the idea is in the future that it won't just be measuring the electrical signals going in, but you might be able to then start putting electrical signals into the body. So paralysis is a really big one. So when someone's, you know, can't connect their brain to their legs anymore, say, you could then have a chip which then actually wants to move the legs, knows how to move the legs because it knows the signature, and then send the correct signal down to the legs. And then obviously a paralyzed person can then walk in, which is amazing. There are so many medical applications, which is the big thing. But then once that's sort of been exhausted, it always then moves to the mass wider adoption where people use it for whatever kinds of reasons. So entertainment's a big one. So controlling games with your mind, VR is a big one. So there is actually like headset attachments you can get, which is like the older version, the non-invasive version of brain machine interfaces and attach those to VR headsets. And then you can, there's some games you can then control with your brain, and then you're just looking at it through the VR, which is kind of cool. Like, you don't need the controller, you don't need anything, you think what you want to do in the game. So I think lastly, because it's very, very interesting, I want to see what your thoughts are. Where do you come down on this and the ethical things? Because at the moment, they're testing on animals, the monkey and pigs and things like that. And obviously, animal testing is a hugely controversial topic. And then eventually, soon, they are going to start doing human trials. And just as like a bit of a background, going back to 2019, at that time, they had performed 19 surgeries on animals. And all they said about those was the wires themselves, the machine, had a success rate of placing the wires in the correct location at 87%. So I don't know what, I mean, that's all they actually said. They didn't say what that meant. I mean, if the wires go into the wrong place, does it mean, oh, it's just unfortunate, now you're reading a part of the brain you're not bothered with? Or does it mean it was a bad surgery? Like 87%, that's not, I mean, it's a good number, but if someone was there saying,
I wouldn't take that odds.
Would you not?
Well, if it was 87%, no, that's far too high on, you know, what could go wrong. With
really, 13% your limit.
Well, what are you kind of, like, unless, I guess it would be a very different if I was, kind of had some kind of disability. Like, if I couldn't see, yeah, I'd take the mods, definitely.
Yeah, but in the enhancement side of it, it's not worth it.
For the just playing a game. I don't know. I think people would be quite funny about the whole chip thing.
Like, all the conspiracy theorists would go crazy with that anyway. I can see the uses from it, but I can't see it catching on for like a for the entertainment side. I can see it as the health side, though. I think that's very good, but not as like a just a normal thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, we'll see where it goes in 20 years' time. Like, what becomes the norm? But that's one of the other sort of issues with it is, one, it's kind of an irreversible thing. You will lose a bit of your skull. If you decide to get rid of it, you know, you'll have to put something else there to like patch the skull up again. So and who knows about taking the chips and the wires out. I don't think they've done that part of the surgery yet. They don't know how to do that bit. Like, once it's in at the moment, it's in. They don't know how to get the wires out. I don't think you could just grab it and pull it out. So, you know, it's an irreversible procedure to undergo.
There's also like the safety side, like all the cyber terrorism.
That's another
stuff.
Big one.
Like, if a cyber terrorist sent like an EMP and just fried everyone's brain.
Yeah.
Like,
no, and
something like that could happen.
One of the things I was reading about was interrogation techniques. And this is all going more into the future now, about when you can put electrical signals into the brain rather than just reading what's already there. Because once you do that, you kind of can control that person. Like, you could send a signal which just creates constant fear in a person. And then there's that idea of being used in interrogations, or even, it sounds funny to say out loud, but mind control, because you could start releasing signals that move someone's body and they aren't moving their body. So if you could hijack someone's chip, you could get them to do anything you want. So I don't know how we're going to deal with all this. It's the same as last week when I was talking about the deepfake stuff. And, you know, in 1990, you had scientists and researchers going, this is a black box. Like, once it's out, it's going to be a weird technology that we're going to have to deal with. And then now in 2020, we're sat here like, people are faking things, politicians are doing whatever. Like, it just opens a can of worms, so to speak. And I think...
Previous episode, by the way, guys.
Previous episode plug there. And I think that's what this is. You know, in 20 years' time, we could look back at this podcast and be like, Jesus Christ, why didn't we shout to say stop it?
That's the scary thing. Like, it sounds so futuristic, but at the same time, there's a monkey playing a game with his brain. Like, think how quick technology goes. Like, it could generally be when we're like 40 or 50.
Yeah, Neuralink is only 4 years old, the company is. Yeah, or just over 4 years. 2016 they were founded. I can't remember when in 2016. So in 4 years they went from literally nothing, just Elon Musk with a bit of money recruiting a lot of neurosurgeons, to making a wireless chip with the most advanced wires on the market today. Well, not on the market, but the most advanced wires used, and they have now have a monkey playing a game with its brain. Like, imagine another 4 years' time where they'll be. So Yeah.
What's next?
That is me. What's next indeed? That is me, mate. I'll hand over to you.
Yes, very good. I enjoyed that.
Did you?
I enjoyed that a lot.
Oh, good. Good. Good.
A lot of deep thought. That's what we bring to this podcast. A lot of deep thought.
Exactly. Exactly.
And on that note, Tom, do you know how long the longest continuous light bulb has gone on for?
What a transition. What a transition. Smooth. Wait, what was the question? How long uninterrupted light bulb has been on?
The continuous light bulb has gone on for. We're going from Neuralinks to light bulbs, mate. This is what we do.
I love it. No. We do say delve into everything in between. So,
yeah, wrong.
I don't know, 20 years. Has it been a light on somewhere for 20 years?
120 years. Since 1901.
Could you imagine if you were, I presume it's in a museum or something.
It's actually in a fire station in America, and it's it was used to as like a safety light, so it would allow the firefighters to see what they were doing. It was really like dim, really low power, but it was never really turned off, so it never had any of the thermal cycles that you usually get with a normal light bulb. Anyway, not going to go into the details.
I was just going to say, I'd love to go and turn that light bulb off now. I'd love to just go and flick it on and be like, there's 120 years gone.
You'd probably get shot. If it's America, you'd probably get shot. But nowadays, so that light bulb has run for over 1 million hours. Mm. You know, light bulbs since then, all the other incandescent ones were rubbish. Anyway, by 1879, Thomas Edison made a light bulb that lasted 14 hours, okay? And then over time, inventors were making these light bulbs last longer and longer, like engineers were coming up with new materials and things. And by about 1920, the average lifetime of a light bulb was 2,000 hours, okay? Which is obviously massive, massive improvement. But then in 1924, there was this secret meeting in Switzerland where these top executives of these light bulb companies, they became known as the Phoebus Cartel. Okay, light bulb cartel, Phoebus cartel. Phoebus is the Greek god of light. So they were called the Phoebus cartel.
Aptly named. So,
and basically they all agreed that they'd reduce the lifetime of their light bulbs by half to 1,000 hours.
Ooh.
So these were like all the biggest like light bulb companies in the world. This was because they were facing the threat of making light bulbs too good. So 1923, one of the companies, the German company, sold 63 million light bulbs, okay? But the following year, they only sold 28 million because they were making these light bulbs that would last much longer and longer and longer.
Oh, so gotcha.
So they all basically agreed 1,000 hours and they'd get all the market cap. You know, it worked. It worked massively for these guys, right? By 1934, sales increased by 25%. And the average lifespan of light bulbs was 1,200 hours.
This is giving me such Apple vibes right now.
Glad you said that, Tom. We're gonna cool. get there. We're gonna get
Okay. Good.
So going back to the longest living light bulb, that was actually before the Phoebus cartel. Hence why it lasted so much longer. Because it wasn't like being made to be rubbish, basically.
Hmm.
But by the late 1930s, World War II happened, and it basically ruined the whole of the Phoebus cartel because they're all obviously different countries that they ended up hating each other and
interesting.
Because there was one of these light bulb companies was in Japan, one of them was in Germany, one of them was in the UK, etc., etc.
It's interesting how they met in Switzerland. Like Switzerland's always just the peace nation, isn't it? That people go to for negotiations of different countries and stuff. Even then,
it's like the peace nation, but also the country for dodgy business dealings.
And that, you know, they've got both sides.
So the Phoebus cartel, the light bulb cartel, was finished. But as you said, with Apple, we see it a lot today.
Mm.
But what companies call it now is planned obsolescence. I'm sure you've probably heard that phrase before now. Or...
No, what does it mean?
Well, planned obsolescence occurs when a company manufactures a device to fail before its realistic lifespan. This usually means like the weaker filament, like for the light bulb, for example.
Is there actually a reason to do it apart from financial gain for the company? Is there any sort of good reason to make something not last as long?
There is when you think of the grander scheme of things. I'm going to come to it in a bit later. There's a couple of positives from it, but I would say the negatives outweigh the positives, but I'll come to it and you can make up your mind with that.
Uh-huh.
So Apple has basically become the king for planned obsolescence and another thing called perceived obsolescence, which I'll talk to in a little bit later. So Apple was the maker of the iPhone, right? And kind of kickstarted the whole smartphone revolution.
Yeah.
But before that, if you had phones, often you could actually remove the battery from. I don't know if you remember, mm-hmm. but like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nokia or Alcatel or whatever. And you could take the battery out. You could put
I was a Razor Flip guy.
Oh, geez. Someone had a bit of money cool. when they were a kid.
I was
a bit of pocket money there.
I was the cool kid on the block. Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. So iPhone, basically, they made it so the battery couldn't be replaced. And after about 2 to 3 years of performance, these batteries would begin to wear out. But it wouldn't be as simple as just changing the battery. Like, they made it so it was very, very difficult. Like, you'd need special screwdrivers. Some of the things said you need suction cups, a soldering gun, potentially, just to replace the battery. And if you did it, you basically screw over your warranty if you have any. And they basically say it's, you know, at your own risk. And that was all designed to basically increase the number of iPhones sold, because it might still be a good phone, but if the battery dies after 2 years, what's the point of having it?
Yeah, I mean, that makes me think about, because like, we're engineers, right? Who at the company thinks and goes, let's do this? Because as an engineer, and I think if I was at a company and the head of it was saying, how can we make this product not last long so our consumers buy more? I'd be really conflicted. And I'd be like, I just want to make the best thing I can make here, man. I want to make, you know, a phone battery that lasts a week or whatever. And there's the accountant going, that's not going to pay the books, though. And I'm just like, well, I don't want to actively, you know.
It's all the politics in it.
That's, yeah.
But that's the real life, unfortunately, Tom.
Yeah, but some engineer somewhere had to go, well, we could do this to the battery. Someone said it somewhere.
But they'll say it as a... You can always word it as a reason for doing that. So Apple would say, oh, you know, we don't want people just to like playing around with their phones because they might damage it. And then they might, you know, say stuff like that. I know it's obviously to cover their own backs, but you can easily put a case across. Imagine being like the light bulb engineer, right? You've been making these filaments like last longer and longer. And then you come back after Christmas and your boss says, shit, sorry, mate, we're going to have to make that a lot worse now. Like, and they do it.
Well, I was just thinking, though, this is where I'm like, maybe you've seen it when you did your research then, but half of my brain's saying, well, that's going to hinder technology getting better, right? You know, if you're not letting an engineer make the best possible light bulb, he's not going to make any advancements. But then also, is there an argument for if you systematically set a limit for the lifetime of a product, you have to constantly keep making a new product and make it a bit better? So does it actually overall make technology progress better because they're getting confined by a lifetime, so to speak, so they have to improve it more regularly?
Yeah,
I don't know, it's just a weird thought.
That whole year life cycle, you could see it as a... It could be a positive. I don't, like, it's impossible to say because there is that pressure then to design and make something better for the next year and the next year.
Yeah, because I was thinking cars. So like, you know, when you think of a 1960s car and how they're made, okay, they could last a day if you kept it clean and whatever. But compared to today's cars, it's terrible emissions and things like that. So actually overall, it's better to make it not last long, because technology improves so rapidly anyway.
In that car situation, yeah. But when it comes to a phone, if you're replacing your phone every 2 years, you're just going to generate much waste.
Yeah. You answered my question. Thank you. Any more questions from the audience?
Any more? So going back to this battery stuff, in 2017, I'm sure you saw it on the news, Apple released an iOS update, which basically made old phones apps run a lot slower, would make the phone crash. And they like this came out, and Apple claimed that they throttled the performance to protect the battery of the older devices and increase the longevity of it. When really that's bullshit, because if they made the battery replaceable in the first place, that wouldn't be a problem. But they were literally doing it to make people like, oh, you know, my old phones can't handle it anymore, I'm gonna have to upgrade. But the lawsuit from that, Apple were forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for it. But now basically they offer battery replacement service from it.
Really?
So, yeah, you can actually go onto Apple website now. So say if you've got an old phone and you want it, like, it does the job, it will cost you about £70 and you can replace your battery in your iPhone. But I guarantee they've put a markup on that battery for sure.
Like, yeah, 100%. Without a doubt.
And like, yeah, you still have to send it to them. It's not like you can just replace the battery or
right yourself. Yeah.
So that was like one of the main things that they've built in. And it sounds like I'm hating on Apple, but all the other companies do it, like Samsung, OnePlus, all them lot, they do, you know, really, this kind of tactic. Yeah. But Apple were the real kings of it. But it doesn't stop there. So think of your screen. If your iPhone's out of warranty, which is only 1 year on Apple iPhones and stuff, to replace the screen, it costs you £200 to £300.
What?
I know. Crazy. And Jesus other repairs, Christ. You can pay up to 50 to 70% of the original cost.
Yeah.
And that's just because they make it really, really difficult. And the only way you can get it repaired is if you send it to them or an approved repair shop. But there's very few of them. So when they make the cost high, you might as well just buy a new model, really.
Yeah, yeah, it's still a tactic, yeah.
If it's not done in hardware, it can be done in software. So I've got like an old iPad, which is like 6 years old now. And
then that doesn't run as fast as it did.
No, but I mean, I use it for like Netflix and stuff, but all the apps.
Oh, yeah, anything else? You watch Netflix on it, I get it, it's fine.
all the apps on it now, they're basically, they say, oh, they need to be updated, but you need the new iOS update, which then isn't offered to my iPad. So you can't actually run a lot of the apps now because they've basically made it too old.
I've seen that's the same with like Android apps as well.
Yeah. When you think of like old security as well. And on the Apple website, they say they expect their devices to last 7 years. After that, they call them obsolete. And you think like, it's just not the case. Like, how many times would you have an iPhone that lasts 7 years? Or
I was going to say 7 years is a decent amount of time, actually, if it lasted the whole 7 years, but whether it's because people buy it or not, I've never seen an iPhone older than, what would 7 years ago be? That would be 2013, 14. Is that iPhone 5? Yeah. I don't see anyone with an iPhone 5. The oldest I ever see is an iPhone SE 1, which is like, I don't know, 4 years, something.
Yeah. But I mean, like, if they wanted you to use their phone for that long, they just give you like a longer warranty or make it more durable, more easier to repair, but they don't. And it's inevitable that you're going to damage something that you carry around all the time, but they make it so hard to like repair it yourself that you then have to buy another one.
Oh, yeah, it's the classic thing with Apple phones anyway. It's like when you drop them, the screen will just crack no matter what. Like, they're the most fragile screens you could possibly get. And every year with a new one, they're like, this is Gorilla Glass. This is the strongest glass you could ever, ever have on a phone. And then I still see people who just drop it occasionally and it's just boom, gone. And they've got to pay £200 to £300. And I've dropped my phone loads of times, my OnePlus. And to be fair, it's never broke. I've never had a broken phone by them. I've had a lot of OnePluses and I've dropped them. Nothing's ever happened. So maybe I've
just... This is not an ad. This is not an ad.
I wish it was an ad. OnePlus, please get in touch. Have you broken a OnePlus phone screen?
Not the front of the screen. Like, I'm not going to lie to you, the back of my one, I did drop on hard concrete and a bit of the glass is broken, but it's not the front, so we're all good.
It's all good.
Sorry to ruin your point there.
just ruined the ad as well.
Fine. Like the glass thing, I do find it mad when we've gone to the moon, we've put things on Mars, but we have glass that like breaks if you drop it like a meter.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's technology, but you think with the billions Apple have, they could definitely come up with something better, but there's no need to because it makes some money.
Yeah. No, anyway, true. I am with you.
I'm not hating on Apple. Okay. Sounds I will be like coming back to Apple though. I will be coming back, but
okay.
I'm not hating on them too much. Okay. There's phones that have gone against this. There's a couple of startups. So one of them is Fairphone, which is worth a Google. I might put a picture of it on the Instagram actually. But
do it.
They make it so you can take parts out, put new parts in, so you can like upgrade it, get a better camera in there. So you can like take the camera out, put it in, you can change the battery, all that lot. And it's all about being more environmentally friendly because you're not just throwing away a whole phone. You can upgrade it or recycle like the bits of it instead of just throwing the whole thing away. So there is room out there. That's just cool. The specs aren't great. And it's one of them startups where they're trying to make a difference, but against the big tech companies, it's hard.
Yeah,
like they're not the only ones. So Tesla, they seem primed to be next.
Not that we keep on plugging Elon Musk on this podcast.
No, but this is a bad one. So they're very reluctant to allow independent garages to service a lot of their cars. So if you want your Tesla repaired, you need to go to a Tesla garage. And if you don't, then they might like you might lose your warranty in your car or something like that. Some TVs have been made to have sensitive parts installed near heat sources. Which then actually reduce the life of the TVs. Yeah, which is pretty interesting. So and there's two-part pricing strategies linked with planned obsolescences, like the real money makers. So if you think of printers, right, they sell you printers, which are inherently quite dodgy anyway. They break, but they then sell you the ink with it, which makes all the money. In some of these ink cartridges, they have chips in them, which then disable the cartridges when they're low. So it doesn't actually allow you to print.
Oh, so you like lose 10% of whatever.
So yeah, you lose some of the ink and you're forced to then replace it with a new one of their kind. Because if you then try and use another one, it won't print.
I don't know about you, but I feel that printer technology is the worst thing we could do. Like no printer works more than a month without something going weird or wrong. And even in offices, you're constantly there, got to try and kick it or something to get it to work. Like we've been printing for years and years and years now, and our TVs are amazing, computers are amazing, but printers break and are the worst piece of tech you can buy. I don't know what it is about them.
Yeah, I guess it's they don't need to innovate really, do they, that much? It's all on their ink.
Well, just make them work. Sorry, I'm having a lot of issues with my printer at the moment.
Yeah, I can venting. Tell. So what's being done about this whole planned obsolescence? So in the EU and 25 states in the US, there's this legislation for the right to repair. So it enforces manufacturers to actually make it a lot easier to repair their products. So they have to provide extra parts. So you could, you know, buy a battery yourself, replace it on your phone without voiding any of your warranties and stuff like that. So there's a bit of a push now to try and make that happen. If this law becomes legislation, does that mean kind of this planned obsolescence will be over? No, not really. Because there's another thing which companies are great at. It's called perceived obsolescence. Do you have any idea what perceived obsolescence would be?
I'm guessing it's when the consumer believes their phone's getting slower, but it actually isn't, but you just feel like it is.
Yeah, I wouldn't say slower, but they think their phone's old or saying on the phones. Okay. In your mind, it's like, oh, I've got the old phone. And it might be working perfectly fine, but you're led to believe that it's the old thing and
I suffer from
the
that.
New one. Yeah, so do I. I'm a massive one for that.
They've got the me newest, well and truly with that.
I want the newest tech ever, but
yeah.
So going back into history, once again, we'd love to dive deep into history. Henry Ford made his first mass market car in 1908, and it's called the Model T. About 1920, 55% of American families had a car. So everyone who could afford one basically had one. But in the 1920s, General Motors started experimenting with paint. So before this, Model T was black, just a black Ford car.
Yeah.
And he made like a joke of saying like, you can have a Model T in every color as long as it's black.
Like, okay.
You can only have it that. And General Motors basically painted cars different colors. and they realized this new trick where you could basically, instead of just trying to outdate the competition's car, the Model T, you can actually outdate your own cars. So if you can bring out a new model every year that has a different color, it then makes the year before's model look old and then makes people end up buying more. So this is what basically people call perceived obsolescence. And I think in 1934, the average car ownership was 5 years, but by 1955, it was only two.
And wow.
Yeah, General Motors was at that point the most valuable company in the world.
It's crazy that a psychology trick from back then is still actually working today. And it does. It works on me. And I actually know like people who do buy the new iPhone every year.
Yeah, like if sticking with Apple, the touch bar on the MacBook Pro, for example, have you seen that on the laptops?
Yeah, yeah. They got rid of it, didn't they? After like one generation, because everyone was just like, what's the point? Or did they not? Exactly, I don't know. Yeah.
Well,
but people didn't like it.
Yeah, it's just like a gimmick, basically, but it's something different. So
people got it and was like, yeah.
You think of like the corners, right? It's gone from like a rounded iPhone to a squared iPhone to a rounded iPhone. To squares one again.
Like, they got some smart marketing people.
It comes from fashion, really. Like in fashion, innovation's kind of impossible. The only way to get people to buy more is to create new styles that are different from the season before. But then what happens when you run out of styles? You just use some in the past and you just keep recycling it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, like flare jeans or something, like things come back and throw, don't they?
But as I said, there is some positives from it. So back in the Great Depression in the 1930s, there was this real estate developer and he proposed this plan, which meant that items should have a lease of life. So shoes, homes, machines. And after that allotted time that they had, it should then be handed back to the government or owner and then destroyed, so they had to buy another one. And it was basically to ensure that people would be spending money and keep people in jobs and keep the cycle rolling to get the country out of the Great Depression. There was a film based on it as well. It was called The Man in the White Suit in the 50s, and the scientists made this white suit that had these fibers that were perfect and could never stain or never break. And it ended up being, spoiler alert, if you're going to watch the film.
I will. So let me just close my ears.
all the factory owners and the workers ended up teaming up and killing him and destroying the suit because they made the suit so good that they didn't have a job. Because
they didn't have to make any more.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So there are positives to it then?
Well, to an extent, like, replaceable products have given all income levels access to more goods that are cheaper, but it also provides a lot of jobs in manufacturing. Like if you think of all like the manufacturers of like the phone cases, for example, they wouldn't have a job if they didn't have a new phone every year. It's keeping them all jobs and things. And like I said, technology being forced to upgrade every year, that's also a good way because it keeps people on the edge. It just depends how much of it's just gimmicks or if it's really trying to push the engineers to like the limit of what's possible.
So like with a lot of things, and it's just a balance really between those two. Because obviously it would ruin the hamster wheel of capitalism if everything lasted forever and people would lose jobs and stuff. But you still want to progress technology. You can't have the same washing machine for 100 years because I'm sure we've come up with a much better way to wash clothes in 100 years time.
Yeah, and there's the whole environmental side. Like I said, with the plastic, war on plastics, if we just keep churning out phones every year, we're going to have so much more plastic waste and things like that. So there's another side to it as well.
Right.
But yeah, so that's about it from me. Just look after your stuff, yeah. Just look after it.
No, that's kind of crazy. I'm actually really shocked. I like that psychology thing because I actually relate to that and I can't believe that it was formed 100 years ago. You think we would have worked out how not to be affected by it by now? Because my phone's like, mine's like four generations old now. It's actually quite old. But, well, I say old, but it's like 2 years old. I do want the new one. But like, does what's it the point work? Of spending the money? Yeah, it works fine. I ain't going to do it. One, I ain't got the money. So, you know, but madness, psychology. Hey,
I know. What was your drink like, Thomas? Because I'm pretty much done.
Well,
here.
I think everyone's had orange juice and vodka in a drink before. So we all know it's all right. It's nothing special.
Does the job.
Some people love it. Some people always go for it. It's just a very simple cocktail. Yeah. What about yours? You actually did something proper.
Yeah, mine was actually very nice. It was similar to the White Lady that I had a few weeks back. The gin based with a bit of lemon juice. So yes, it was good. Recommend.
Nice, man. Nice. Well, then, thank you for listening, guys. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. Make sure you go follow the Instagram. We're also out on a lot more platforms now, actually. Should probably say that. Podcast Addict, we're on there now. But then again, to be honest, if you're listening to this, you already have found us. So this is not the place to advertise that. Yeah, let's just end the podcast there, Tobes.